Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Gaffney tonight, and we have a full program which we want to get right into, but before we do, a little bit of a housekeeping measure that we want to include you with. As you know, over the next 3 weeks, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, and the Director of the CIA will be positions that will be filled possibly by John Kerry, former Senator Chuck Hagel, and the current National Counterterrorism Director, John Brennan, are going to be trying to get those jobs. If you were a member of Congress sitting in judgment, what question would you pose to those individuals? If you want to call and leave us a message and answer that question, the number is 800-332-7131. That's 800-332-7131. All right, so much for that. Let's get into our program tonight. Pleased to welcome back one of our regular contributors, Roger Noriega, the former Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs in the George W. Bush administration, also served as the U.S. Permanent Representative to the Organization of American States. He is now at the American Enterprise Institute, and he raised some eyebrows last week at a luncheon in which he was essentially saying border security is no longer just a function of patrolling the boundaries between U.S., Mexico, and Canada. Roger, thanks for being with us. And I want to jump right in here, because what is still sticking in my mind is apparently Mexican drug cartels are now operating in over 1,200 U.S. cities. How serious is this threat, and what steps are we taking to prevent it?
Well, these drug cartels represent the biggest organized crime threat in the United States, and 40% of the 1.4 million street gangsters in this country have some association, do some work for these cartels, either through the distribution of drugs. So they reach out right to our street corners. Every street corner, every schoolyard is threatened by this network. And I think we just don't understand that there's this transnational threat that reaches all the way down, certainly into Colombia and Bolivia, where the cocaine comes from, but abetted by a Venezuelan narco state. And this network destabilizes four or five countries in Central America, certainly Mexico, right up to our border. It's a form of asymmetrical warfare, really, and it pays for itself. And we have also noted a very close relationship with terrorist groups like Hezbollah, with these narco-traffickers. So this is a threat that's metastasized, really, on President Obama's watch. And we have to get our arms around this problem before it gets its hands around our throats.
But first, we have to acknowledge it exists. I mean, you mentioned cities, principally Chicago, Los Angeles, Atlanta, major metropolitan areas. And at least in Chicago, I know they operate out of obviously strong Mexican-American or Latino neighborhoods. What is being done to protect those neighborhoods from this kind of narco state infiltration? And who is in charge of this? I would think it would be the Department of Justice.
Well, certainly, and I think the DEA does an effective job of dealing with the symptoms, really. Mm-hmm. These folks sort of preoccupy themselves tracing down shipments of cocaine and marijuana and that sort of thing. But we need to look at tearing this problem out at the roots, and it, quite frankly, we're never going to get our hands around this problem unless we get ahead of the curve on the problem, unless we recognize that this is a narco state in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez's anti-American regime that abets the narco trafficking in its territory, dozens of suspicious flights every day into Central America and into the Caribbean, carrying drugs. And it supports not only the narco-trafficking criminal network, but the terrorist network. And as you alluded to, the executive branch particularly the policy folks, the diplomats, national security establishment, don't want to recognize that these folks work together and are becoming a more and more acute threat to our security every day.
Well, let me talk a little bit about that, because you alluded to the connection with Hezbollah in the U.S.-Mexican drug trade, and I assume that involves the Sinaloa cartel as well as the various narco states. What is their role? How do they function inside this universe?
The Hezbollah folks obviously function using the same sort of trafficking routes, the same sort of methods for money laundering, the same criminal networks for that the drug traffickers use for distribution, they use for want to use for infiltrating U.S. territory. So this is, they also generate vast amounts of money by abetting money laundering transactions alongside Colombian cartels, using banks from Europe to Lebanon to Africa to Mexico. And so this is a vast, sophisticated network.
So in other words, what we're looking at is a very sophisticated and deeply infiltrated drug business, a vertically integrated business to fund terrorist operations in the United States.
Absolutely. And two important problems, at least, have to be illuminated. The fact that we totally ignore, as I've suggested, the problem of the Venezuelan narco state and the role they play, and the fact that we have no serious dialogue with the Mexicans on the role of Hezbollah in their territory. The Mexicans are very defensive about it. They don't want to talk about it. And if we can't figure out a way to talk about this problem, it's going to hurt us very, very badly. And the sort of debacles and episodes where a few lives are lost in Benghazi are going to be dwarfed by the cost that we're going to pay for the inability of our diplomats and our national security establishment to deal with this issue.
I have to say, Roger, though, until I heard your discussion, the whole level of sophistication and penetration of so-called narco states was something I wasn't familiar with. And I want to lead into that because you've recently written a piece about Iran being a regional threat beyond the Middle East. And of course, we know about their presence to some degree in Venezuela. But my understanding, based on what you've told us, is that even countries like Ecuador are now involved in some kind of dialogue or participation with the Iranians, to say nothing of Cuba.
Yes, these anti-American regimes certainly are inspired and pushed by Venezuela, but they are, in their own right, have reached out to the Iranians. The President Rafael Correa of Ecuador, very defiant about carrying on a commercial relationship, including purchasing Iranian oil, about $400 million worth of Iranian oil recently, in defiance of international sanctions. And then the Iranians have not only a diplomatic presence there, a physical presence, but they are able to launder money through Ecuador's dollarized economy. And then they're also mining. The Iranians are mining in suspicious ways, not only in Venezuela, but in Bolivia as well and in Ecuador. So this network is very dangerous.
Yeah. Well, that leads to my last question. You may have heard at the beginning of the program, I suggested to our listeners a way to include themselves in the questioning of potentially the next Secretary of State, John Kerry. Let me put that to you. If you were sitting on the Senate panel that will review Senator Kerry's nomination for Secretary of State, what question would you pose him?
Well, certainly I would say ask him, why are U.S. diplomats today talking to the Venezuelan regime about normalizing relationships without recognizing the extraordinary damage that would do not only to the hopes of democracy in Venezuela, but more importantly for us, the fact that Venezuela is a narco state, and normalizing relations with that state would undermine ongoing DEA investigations against senior Venezuelan officials who are involved in narco trafficking and support for terrorism.
To your knowledge, has Senator Kerry weighed in on this issue at all as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee? I certainly can't recall anything he said about this, either pro or con.
No, I've never seen any comment by him. He is certainly part of an establishment that is loath to recognize this challenge and intends to underestimate it. and suggest that anyone who's raising the alarm are merely alarmists.
Well, Roger, thanks for raising the alarm with us, and we will take your question to heart and hopefully get back to you very soon about the whole question of narco states establishing beachheads in the United States. Roger Noriega, now with the American Enterprise Institute, formerly Assistant Secretary of State for the Western Hemisphere Affairs. We'll be right back after these words.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals, managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Gaffney. And you have no doubt been hearing, certainly on this program, a lot of discussion about former Vice President Al Gore's recent sale of Current TV to, of all places, Al Jazeera. And you may be asking yourself, wait a minute, I thought Al Gore was a green gladiator extraordinaire. What is he doing selling out to an oil-rich country like Qatar, which, of course, owns Al Jazeera? Well, our next guest has written an article that says, don't be so surprised. Perhaps Al Gore's connections to big oil are a couple of generations old. I'm talking about Robert Zubrin, who I'm pleased to say is a fellow at the Center for Security Policy, but he is also the president of Pioneer Astronautics, which is an aerospace research and development company in Colorado. And his latest book is called Merchants of Despair, Radical Environmentalists, Criminal Pseudoscientists, and the Fatal Cult of Anti-Humanism. And if you find National Review Online, his article, Al Gore's Payday, is well worth reading. Robert, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
All right, so tell us a little bit about Al Gore's family connection to big oil, because I'm sure a lot of us, and I'm one of those, did not know.
Well, it's not so much a question to big oil as such, but to foreign interests adversarial to the United States. Al Gore's father was a very influential congressman, and upon his retirement, he received a huge payoff from a man named Armand Hammer, and he also received federal payoffs while he was still congressman. He was appointed to be CEO of Armand Hammer U.S. coal subsidiary called Island Creek Coal. It was a wholly owned subsidiary of Occidental Petroleum, which was owned by Hammer. Now, who was Hammer? Hammer was an agent of the Soviet Secret Service from 1922 on. This has been extensively documented. There's a book that I cite in the article called Dossier by Epstein. People can find it on Amazon. Hammer personally knew Lenin, Stalin, Khrushchev, Brezhnev, Andropov, and Gorbachev. He was an agent of the Soviet Union from 1922 through 1990. And he gave a lot of money to Al Gore Sr. Why? Because Al Gore Sr. did two very important things for him. One, Hoover, the FBI director, from prosecuting Hammer, because it was known to the FBI that Hammer was a paymaster for the Soviet Secret Service. And two, he arranged for Hammer, who was head of Occidental Petroleum, to get control of the Libyan oil fields, which has proved a bonus for Hammer and also helped assist in the transition of Libya into the Soviet camp under Gaddafi. So here you have a very powerful U.S. congressman doing work for the Soviet Secret Service and getting paid for it. Now, what has Al Gore Jr. done for Qatar? Isn't he against oil? Yeah, he's against U.S. oil. Okay, this is it. I mean, look, the environmental movement, which obviously is not entirely Al Gore's creature, but he is its spearhead, its leading champion.
Absolutely.
Has been responsible for turning the United States from the world's leading oil exporter into the world's leading oil importer. The United States invented the oil industry. As late as World War II, we produced twice as much oil as the entire rest of the world put together. Today, we produce 8%. Why? Our oil production peaked in 1971, which is the very same year that the Environmental Protection Agency was established, that the National Environmental Policy Act went into effect, which is what gave the environmental movement muscle. And they have been cramping and cramping down and making it more and more impossible to drill for oil here, as well as hurting U.S. industry in other areas. So you might say if the U.S. oil industry had continued to grow at the rate of 3% per year, which it had during the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, right up to 1971, instead of producing 5.5 million barrels of oil a day today, we'd be producing 35 million barrels of oil a day today. And the difference of 30 million barrels is precisely the entire output of OPEC. In other words, if we had been allowed to continue to develop our oil in the way that we had done historically, OPEC would be completely marginal. They would not be able to control the world price of oil. And instead of oil today going for $90 a barrel, it would be going for $30 a barrel. And that difference of $60 a barrel would, by itself, and just in terms of price, would be saving the United States $240 billion a year, okay, but in foreign exchange. But if you can consider that we'd also not be importing any oil at all, but be exporting it, it would be much bigger. It would be approaching $1 trillion.
Based on what you're laying out here, it does not seem far-fetched to assume that to some degree, Al Gore, despite his environmental credentials to the contrary, is essentially an agent of Qatari oil.
Yeah. If not for this environmental movement, Qatar's oil profits would be cut by at least a factor of three. And that's, of course, true of the Saudis and the rest of them, and Iran, for that matter. So what's funding the Iranian nuclear bomb program is oil exports at artificially rigged up prices, which are only possible because of the suppression of the American oil industry. So people say, well, you know, this is just an example of petrodollar recycling. Yeah, it sure is. It's an example of the U.S. being looted of cash by rigged up oil prices, and then the people doing it taking that money and buying up control of assets in the United States. This is not the only example. Prince bin Talil of Saudi Arabia has bought up major stakes in CNN and in Fox, actually, and even the Wall Street Journal. And this is corrupting our political dialogue, because if you have agents of this foreign cartel taking positions in U.S. media, among other places, They have the ability to influence our discussion, which is one reason why I think that the Congress has been unable to craft any competent energy policy ever since the problem has been made apparent with the 73 embargo.
Well, you know, the other thing that's obviously clear here is if we are essentially underwriting indirectly, obviously, oil profits to Qatar and to Saudi Arabia, then we are also underwriting independently the exportation of Wahhabism and terrorism from those two countries, which we know have ties to organizations like Al-Qaeda and various other terrorist groups.
Well, sure. And it's not just Qatar. It's Saudi. It's Iran. It's all of them. I mean, it's oil money that is funding the jihad internationally. That's what's promoting it. Look, the Taliban was created as a Saudi project. They created over 1,000 madrasas in Pakistan alone to teach young boys jihadi ideology and arm them and send them forth to first take over Afghanistan and now to carry out operations against U.S. forces.
So why do you suppose, Robert, that you and I are having this conversation, unfortunately independent of oversight committees in both the House and the Senate?
Well, you know, it's pretty odd because, see, look, I own, as you mentioned, a small aerospace company, and there are laws in effect to prevent any influence peddling. So like, if I was to take a NASA middle manager out to dinner and pick up the tab, the inspector general would be all over both of us. Oh, you might be bribing him. But here you have a person, Al Gore, who was a U.S. congressman, a U.S. senator, and vice president of the United States of America, getting a $100 million payoff from a foreign government that is engaged in economic warfare against the United States and the promotion of terrorism internationally. And what does the attorney general do? I think that we really need to have laws that prevent U.S. government officials taking payoffs from foreign governments, either directly from the government or, for example, in the case of Armand Hammer or Al Jazeera, what the governments typically don't give the money directly out of their treasury. They give it through some business that they control. Okay, you know, so the payoff comes through Occidental Petroleum or the payoff comes through Al Jazeera. Okay, people who are entrusted with U.S. government jobs must be prevented from accepting any gifts, okay, or profitable business arrangements of any kind with foreign entities of this character.
Well, I would have to say, and I think you made this point yourself in your article, that if somebody like Mitt Romney or a prominent Republican office aspirant had done something like this, committees would be all over this like white on rice. And to my knowledge, not even Homeland Security is looking into this at this point.
Sure. And so here you have Al Jazeera, which promotes jihadism. Now it's going to be on U.S. cable TV. It will be watched in U.S. prisons, okay, where jihadists are doing substantial recruitment among prisoners and in neighborhoods. It will help promote this. I mean, really, this is a quisling operation. And, you know, I mean, frankly, even if there wasn't a law, you would think that any person who had been given the trust of the American people to the extent that Al Gore has would have the probity to say, no, I'm not going to do business with Al Jazeera. You know, Al Jazeera has attempted to interview me on Space Manners. I turned them down. You know, I said, look, you know, my stepson's in the infantry. I'm not going to give you an interview. Go away.
Well,
and you would think that someone would have sufficient ethics not to take a payoff of this character and afford this much benefit to the jihad.
Well, you know, what you're talking is common sense, but unfortunately, as Voltaire said a couple of hundred years ago, common sense is not so common. Robert, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks for bringing this to our attention, and we were obviously going to stay on the Al Jazeera case. If Congress doesn't take it up, there may be some cable subscribers across the country who need to know this as well. Thanks so much for being with us, and we'll be right back after these words.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It is with sound mind and body that I, James Fredericks III, after fighting with all direct family members for decades, leave my entire fortune of $32 million to the one friend I had in the end, the package delivery guy, Matt Songer.
Woohoo! Yeah! I had a feeling about this. Uh-huh! I'm rich! Oh, this cannot be happening.
Actually, it's not happening.
What?
And it never will.
I don't get it.
There aren't even people here. That's just one of those murmuring sound effects.
Seriously?
Listen, if you want to have money in your future, don't rely on luck.
Huh.
Put $10 away each month. Cook once in a while instead of eating out.
Okay.
Pay down your high-interest credit cards.
Right.
Small changes today, big bucks tomorrow.
So, no inheritance?
No. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
And just to be clear, no inheritance, right?
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The world has a very direct way of demonstrating that America is perceived to be so weak that it can be taken on, even by those who are, in relative terms, infinitely weaker. One of the most dramatic is hostage taking. In 1979, Iranian jihadists displayed their contempt for President Jimmy Carter and the U.S. military he had hollowed out by attacking our embassy in Tehran. As the new Hollywood blockbuster Argo reminds us, our countrymen were allowed to be held hostage there for over a year, underscoring our national impotence. Yesterday, Americans were again taken hostage, this time by Al-Qaeda jihadists in Algeria. It coincided with a dramatic warning by seven top military commanders that pending budget cuts risk creating another hollow force. We truly can't afford to go there. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedomradio.com.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement? And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
I'm a champion, realize checks mechanism. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hi, Shaquille O'Neal for Rad. This is not your normal PSA. Don't be stupid. Don't drink and drive. If you're gonna go out and have a good time, it's fine. But designate a driver to drive home. Let's stop the madness. Don't drink and drive.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Affney. I want to remind you again that if you have a question for John Kerry, who wants to be the next Secretary of State, leave it at 800-332-7131. And speaking of world affairs, nobody better to talk to than Fred Flights, who we speak to every week at this time. He is the managing editor of the Langley Intelligence Group Network, former CIA analyst for a couple of decades, former chief of staff to John Bolton when he was at the Department of State himself, and the former senior advisor to the former chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, Pete Hoekstra. Fred, as we are doing this interview, news is breaking. I know that you have just put out something on Algeria, a hostage situation there. What can you tell us?
Well, the conflict in Mali late last week, France sent a military force into Mali because it looked like Islamist terrorists were going to take control of the whole country. The conflict changed yesterday when Islamist terrorists in Algeria seized a gas plant and an unknown number of hostages. We hear about 65 foreign hostages, possibly hundreds of Algerian hostages, and probably
within the last 12 hours or so, the Algerian army attempted an attack on the gas plant that resulted in what France 24 is calling a bloodbath, where 35 hostages and 15 hostage takers were killed. And the hostage takers claim they conducted this terrorist activity to protest Algeria's decision to let French aircraft cross Algerian airspace to intervene into Mali. In a similar action, a French intelligence officer was killed probably Friday or Saturday, probably executed. He had been taken hostage in Somalia in 2009. He was also killed in retaliation to France's intervention in Mali.
But if that's true, I mean, one of the reports we're getting is one of the people who may be involved with the terrorist is a fellow named Mokhtar Belmokhtar, who is a pretty well-known AQIM, Al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb terrorist, a veteran in Afghanistan. And I would think if this guy was involved, he would be casting a wider net than just the French. I mean, obviously, we know there's some Americans involved, but do you think they're just going after French, or are they trying to send a message to us as well?
Oh, they are sending a message to us. They took a lot of hostages at this gas plant. It looks like they let go most of the Algerian hostages, and they kept the Western hostages, including Americans, Irish, Japanese, South Koreans, and quite a number of French. And this is basically an effort to try to twist the arms of the West and use fear to force the French to withdraw from Mali.
Now the Algerian government, at least what little we know of it, is essentially siding with the French here, unlike a lot of countries that are turning over to the Islamic side in northern Africa. How strong is the Algerian government, and how long can we trust them as allies?
The Algerians have been very reluctant to supporting any multilateral operation in Mali, and it was extraordinary, given the long hostility between Algeria and France, that it agreed to let France cross its airspace. Algeria recognized the situation in Mali was becoming a serious threat. Basically, the Islamists there were developing into a regional terrorist base. And as you know, there were terrorists from this area that were probably involved in this September 11, 2012 attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi. So Algeria had to intervene. The problem is, Algeria is still extremely reluctant to allow any foreign nation help them or send troops to the country. So there's no chance that French or American troops are going to be allowed into Algeria to help resolve this hostage situation. Algeria has had trouble with Islamist hostages for a long time, including in the 1990s, when the Islamists won an election and tried to outlaw democracy and there was a bloody civil war. They know they have their own way of cracking down on Islamists. It's extremely harsh, it's extremely brutal, and they're not going to compromise or negotiate.
Then let's turn back to Mali, because obviously that's still a very volatile situation. France seems to be very much involved. The Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, has raised, obviously, concerns, but has, at this point, committed no troops. What should our concern in the United States be, and what is our potential role, if any, in that conflict?
Well, Panetta has said there's not going to be any boots on the ground, but he said something late yesterday that he considered the incident in Algeria to be a terrorist attack, and I thought he was hinting at some increased American role. Now, the United States was training the Mali army until last spring, when some of the troops we were training actually launched a coup that led to the Islamists to take control of the north of the country. Under U.S. law, we had to stop training Mali's army. I understand the Obama administration is trying to find a way around that legal restriction so they can at least provide training to beef up Mali's army so they can resist the Islamists. We're providing intelligence support and transport to the French military, but I don't see any prospect of American soldiers entering Mali to fight alongside the French.
Well, without some kind of foreign support, how long can the established government in Bamako withhold the onslaught from the north, from the Islamist forces?
They would fall. Without French support, they were going to fall. Their army was going to collapse. The French saw that. France did not want to do this, especially under President Francois Hollande, who's very anti-interventionist. this was a desperation move. The question now is how long will Hollande and the French people support a French operation? Yesterday, a French official said that we're in for an extended guerrilla war in Mali. I find it hard to believe that the French public will stand for that for any extended period of time. Now, there are not a lot of Mali insurgents, and the French army may be able to take them out fairly quickly, but I think they're going to pay a high cost.
But what is the high cost to all of us if Mali becomes an Islamist state?
It would be a disaster. This would be a major, this would be an Al-Qaeda state just a few hundred miles from Europe. I mean, it would be a serious regional threat. And we're already seeing with the Islamist attacks in Algeria and the execution of the French hostage in Somalia, that they are prepared to conduct terrorist activities outside the region, way outside their reach. And I should add the Benghazi incident to that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We're talking about this, and I know you have another story about Al-Qaeda growing stronger in the Egyptian Sinai, and I can't help, you know, totaling all of these up, Fred, and saying I'm contrasting this with the official government narrative that Al-Qaeda is on its last legs. How much evidence to the contrary do we need?
Well, I mean, the Obama administration has played down the threat from terrorism since the day they came into office, and this began with Jen Napolitano's effort to try to remove the word terrorism from the U.S. government lexicon and replaced it with the ridiculous term man-caused disasters. They're now sort of using the word terrorism, but they really still play it down, and they just don't want to admit that there is a continuing war on terrorism ongoing, and that Al-Qaeda and its franchises, although they've been beaten down, they have not been eliminated, and they're sprouting up in many areas, especially across northern Africa.
Well, if that's true, then that leads to my last question. As you know, John Kerry is going to be sitting in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee next week, hoping to become the next Secretary of State. Let me put the question we've been putting our listeners, to our listeners to you. If you were sitting on the Senate panel, what question would you ask Senator Kerry?
Well, I mean, I think the most obvious question that should be asked to him is, Senator Kerry, is there still a war on terrorism? Let him explain his position. His position so far is that there hasn't been. And when he denies it, I think the senator should follow up with all the instances you and I just discussed and try to have him explain his worldview in light of what's going on in Mali and Sinai and Libya and Tunisia and various other areas.
Well, you know, that's a compelling question. I don't know who is going to do that, but it seems to me that if we do not get those answers sooner rather than later, we're going to be looking at more dominoes falling across northern Africa and elsewhere.
I think that's right.
All right. Well, Fred, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking with Fred Flights at the Langley Intelligence Group. He comes to us every week with insights. And Fred, thanks for your update on Algeria. And hopefully by the time we talk again, that situation will be successfully resolved. Wink, wink, nod, nod. We'll be right back after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call. And I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Dennis Prager thinks there should be a simple standard to textbooks.
I'll tell you how I think a textbook should be written. This is what happened. Period.
That is the role of the text.
And if nearly everybody who did something important in American history, if 78.9% of them were WASP males, then I want 78.9% of the textbook to reflect that fact.
I care about truth.
That's why I'm not on the left.
The Dennis Prager Show. Weeknights at 10 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy in the chair for Frank Gaffney tonight. And it's pretty hard to have a discussion of world affairs and national security without including Israel, and we're certainly not going to do that tonight. For that, we're going to turn to a recognized authority on national security, terrorism, the Middle East. He is the correspondent for CBN that you probably know very well if you watch Stackelbeck on Terror, and the author of a book called The Terrorist Next Door. And if you know nothing about terrorism, if you know nothing about the infiltration of the Muslim Brotherhood, this is the best place to start. He is also a frequent guest and often the host for Glenn Beck, if you're following Glenn Beck on TV. Of course, I'm talking about Eric Stackelbeck, who's just back from Israel. Have I got that right?
I am, Fred. Thanks so much for the introduction, too. Yeah, incredible stay in Israel right after Operation Pillar of Defense, so very timely as well.
So tell us about it. I mean, what did you learn there, and how is Israel ramping up its defenses?
Yeah, a few things, Fred. I spent time along the Gaza border. This is, like I said, a few days after the engagement with Hamas. The consensus there among Israeli military types along the Gaza border was, you know what, this is not over. It's going to ramp up again. We're going to see another conflict with Hamas in Gaza. It's only a matter of time. That's one thing I took from it. Another thing I took from it was major, major concern about Syria and about that Syrian border. Remember, northeast Israel, you have the border with the Golan Heights, you have the border with Syria. According to some Israeli officials, Fred, the quote-unquote Syrian rebels slash Al-Qaeda slash the Muslim Brotherhood
right.
now have control of Syria's border with Israel. Very, very concerning for the Israelis. Also concerned about Jordan and the Muslim Brotherhood there. And Saudi Arabia, which is a real wild card. I heard some concern expressed, Fred, about the regime in Saudi Arabia maybe going by the wayside as well.
Well, don't we also have to worry about Al-Qaeda ramping up in the Sinai? I mean, assuming that the reports out of there are true, that's another area where the Israelis may have to beef up their defenses, like that fence that they're building.
Yeah, Fred, great point. I wanted to get down to the Sinai. It's funny you mention that. Wanted to get down to the Sinai. Did not have time at the end of the day. But what a hotbed that's becoming. The Sinai is becoming another base in Al-Qaeda's global jihad. There's going to be a fence there, and there's also going to be a fence, again, along that Syrian border, Fred. I think a 45-mile-long fence the Israelis are building to keep out the global jihadists that are entrenching themselves in Syria as well. So let's look at Israel's immediate surroundings. Sinai, global jihadists. Syria, global jihadists. Lebanon, Hezbollah. Gaza, Hamas, Jordan, quite possibly the Muslim Brotherhood. There is a lot of concern that Jordanian regime is kind of teetering on the brink. The Brotherhood is really making a show of force there, along with the Salafis. They're making a show of force there, Fred. They're in the streets. They're protesting. They're making a lot of racket. And that Jordanian government with King Abdullah is not very strong. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens there.
As I recall, the Muslim Brotherhood in Jordan is known as what, the Islamic Action Front, something like that.
Yes.
I mean, it's essentially the same circus in a different tent. But I mean, we've been doing reports on Jordan that indicate that King Abdullah may actually be threatened.
Absolutely. Without a doubt, I believe, number one, he's threatened. I believe, number two, the best case scenario for him, I guess, would be if he kind of allowed the Muslim Brotherhood a greater role in his government under the guise of, okay, democracy, this will shut everyone up, all the Islamist stuff. I'll give him a chunk of the government. That's what he might do, but that is a very, very bad move for him, Fred, if he does that, because as we know, the Muslim Brotherhood's not there just to be kind of part of the scene. They must dominate. Their ideology demands Sharia states, caliphate. The Brotherhood cannot coexist in any kind of functioning government in the long term. They might play the Qatiya deception game for a few years, but eventually they must dominate. Their ideology demands it.
Well, if past is prologue, you know, Mubarak tried the same thing with the Brotherhood, allowing them to stand for elections, I believe, 3 or 4 years ago, and we know what happened to him. So I guess no good deed goes unpunished by the established rulers in the Middle East. But, you know, it's ironic, Eric, because guys like Mubarak or Bashar Assad in Syria, brutal dictators that they were probably better friends and better protectors of Israel than what's coming up.
Isn't that the truth, Fred? I mean, it is so true. Mubarak, Gaddafi, not friends of Israel at the end of the day.
No.
But you know what? Especially with Mubarak, a cold peace with Israel. He knew it was in his interest to crack down on Hamas, to crack down on Al-Qaeda, to keep a good relationship with Israel, good relationship in Muslim terms, which is, like I said, a cold peace. Please the Americans, stay on our good side, keep taking in his billions of dollars of aid. Hey, look, unsavory guy, Hosni Mubarak, without a doubt, oppressive at home. But you know what? In the Middle East and in Egypt, sad to say, Fred, and you know this, he's about as best as we could have hoped for.
Yeah.
That's not saying much, but Mubarak is about as good as you're going to get in the Middle East, where it's either fascist dictators like a Bashar al-Assad or Islamist dictators like we see emerging now throughout the region.
Well, unfortunately, we don't even have the best of bad choices anymore, Eric, which leads me to my next question, because obviously while you were in Israel checking out their security, you must have done a little bit of G2 on their dome missile defense. How good is that, and what lessons can we learn from what they've done there?
You know, Fred, they are very proud of Iron Dome, and they're very excited about it. I actually got an up-close look at Iron Dome. I was in the Ashkelon region in
mm-hmm.
southern Israel.
Sure.
There's only 5 of these Iron Dome batteries around the country. The main thing I took from it is, look, number one, very successful, very effective. Anytime missiles were coming in to a civilian area, Iron Dome will pretty much ignore a missile if it's just going to fall in the desert. But if a missile or a rocket is heading towards a civilian area, Iron Dome had an 85% success rate in shooting those missiles down. That's a big deal. Number two, what I took from it is, man, this thing is very expensive, very expensive. That's why they have 5 of them right now. The Israelis need more. They need more, especially up north with Hezbollah, who has 50 to 60,000 rockets. It's funny, too, Fred. I mean, when you see Iron Dome up close, I expect it from the news reports, this gargantuan system. It's really not that big. It's really not that impressive to the naked eye when you see it up close. But as I said, very, very effective. And as our country is slashing missile defense and basically letting it go by the wayside under the Obama administration, the Israelis are ramping it up. And I think we should take a page out of their book, to say the least, especially with North Korea, Iran working on ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, which can reach the United States.
Well, that leads me to my final question. I don't know if this has happened since you've returned to the United States, but you're obviously aware now that there's been quite a bit of publication of Mohamed Morsi's statements referring to the Israelis and, to that degree, Americans and Christians as apes and pigs, and his vitriol against Zionists prior to becoming the president. But that's been followed by a very tepid reaction by Senator John McCain, who says, I hate what he's saying, but I still want to give him $480 million. And Jay Carney at the White House and said, well, let's look at his deeds and not his words. What does that all mean to the Israeli right now, Eric? I mean, are they taking any confidence at all from U.S. policy?
No, Israel's alone, Fred. They're alone. They've been alone since 2009. Now, especially in a second Obama term, all the restrainers are gone. This is who Barack Obama is. This is why he's choosing a guy like Chuck Hagel, who's an anti-Semite, in my view, as his defense secretary. John Kerry, John Brennan, who are not friendly to Israel, also among his top advisors. With Morsi, look, it took the White House 2 weeks to respond to this tape of him calling Jews apes and pigs. And by the way, also, Fred, in that tape, he called America the enemy. He talked about the American enemy. Now, this administration has thrown in their lot with the Brotherhood, and they're in it for the long haul with the Brotherhood. Means Israel completely isolated. Also bad. Very bad for America, because, Fred, as you've talked about so eloquently, the Brotherhood is here, and they have entree into our government, into this administration.
All right. Well, talking about this administration, as you know, John Kerry will sit in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee next week, try to become the next Secretary of State. Want to give you the same opportunity we've given to all our guests and listeners tonight. If you were sitting on that Senate panel, what would be your pointed question to John Kerry?
I think a few. I think, Fred, he was the guy, remember, the first high-ranking American official who went to Egypt to meet with the Muslim Brotherhood after the Egyptian Revolution. Mm-hmm. He was a guy, and Kerry came back saying, these are good guys, we can work with them. I would nail him down with what you just discussed, comments like the apes and pigs comments, Morsi, American enemy, Morsi. I would nail Kerry down and really squeeze him on the Brotherhood, their ideology. That's what I would do. I would try to get answers out of him. And also, Iran, look, if sanctions don't work, which I don't believe they will, what then?
Yeah.
What then?
Well, we're going to have
two major questions.
We're going to have to leave it there, Eric. But if you could, between now and next week, if you could get yourself elected to the Senate, be very helpful, because we could use
you back too, Fred.
Well, I don't think John McCain's going to ask questions like that, but at least you are. Eric Stackelbeck, thanks for being with us, and that's going to do it for Secure Freedom Radio tonight. Don't forget, if you want to leave a message for John Kerry, 800-332-7131. This is Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Affney. I'll be back tomorrow night. Until then, stay safe.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio.